This podcast is brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short. You can find more podcasts and other resources on our website, www.acamh.org, and follow us on social media by searching ACAMH.
Hello, I'm Ella Rhodes, and welcome to the Association of Child and Adolescent Mental Health's In Conversation podcast. Today I'm speaking to the Association's chair, Professor Stephen Scott, who's a consultant child and adolescent psychiatrist who works across the Maudsley Hospital and King's College London.
My name is Stephen Scott. I'm chair of the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, also known as ACAM. My background is I did a degree in psychology, but then studied medicine and was a paediatrician for a while, but got more interested in children's development and well-being. So now I work in the NHS as a psychiatrist in a specialist clinic for children with conduct problems and adoption fostering, and at King's College London, the Institute of Psychiatry, Psychology and Neuroscience, as a professor of child health and behaviour.
Thanks so much for joining us today, Stephen. I really appreciate it. So you've had a really interesting career path, really. Would you be able to tell us a little bit more about why you went from psychology to paediatrics and on to child and adolescent psychiatry? What kind of drove you in that direction?
Well, I had the rather grandiose idea as a young man of trying to do it all, looking after children's bodies and their souls, as it were, their well-being. But it soon became apparent that I could either be slaving over hot babies in a premature unit for neonates, or I could look after their well-being specifically without doing the physical side. And interestingly, I found what I'm doing now more challenging intellectually and more satisfying than rather routinized pediatric care. So that's why I wanted to get into this field. And I always wanted not just to be a researcher, but somebody who could have hands-on experience of making children and families feel better and happier.
And what kind of made it such a intellectual challenge for you? Is it just kind of the complexity of the issues that you're seeing?
Yes, I think if somebody comes in with asthma, you know what investigations to do and what treatment to give. Every child I see, you have an idea from the referral letter, but everybody's different. The mixture of issues, the mixture of the effect to which it's due to, shall we say, genes and or the way they've been brought up, is going to be different in every case, and you have to tease that out, and you've got to engage the young person, you've got to engage the parents to help explain it to them and help them find out what's going to work. So I love it. Every time is different.
And your work encompasses so many different strands. I was just wondering if you could tell us about what your kind of day-to-day work looks like on your in your specialist centre for conduct disorders and fostering and adoption, and a little bit about some of your research as well.
Sure. Well, the day-to-day clinical work is assessing what's going on. For example, in adopted and fostered children, they will have had a terrible start in life, usually with neglect and abuse. But also they may have other issues that are mainly genetically determined. They often come from more disadvantaged backgrounds genetically, so they might have generalized learning disabilities or ADHD, as well as attachment and trauma issues. So we see these children, we assess them, and then we try and do treatments that have been proven to work. One of my little hobby horses is that just because they are fostered and adopted doesn't mean to say they're from Mars and the usual things don't work. So there can be an overuse of the term attachment disorder, whereas in fact more ordinary things are going on which are amenable to treatment. So that's what I do in my clinic. My research has been particularly about what works for disruptive children as well as adopted and fostered ones, and I've done a number of trials finding out whether helping parents to help the children for younger children works, and it does very well, and also what works with younger adolescents who are going off the rails and may be in trouble with the law. So I've spent a lifetime doing trials on that and what works, and what we found is that the skill of the practitioner is particularly important. More skilled practitioners get a good effect, and that early intervention in terms of age does help. It's harder to treat adolescents, but still not impossible.
And with kind of conduct problems in particular, what sort of approaches do you take kind of treatment-wise with that sort of group of children and young people?
Sure. And these are a very unfashionable group of people. Parents who have children who are misbehaving, difficult, being excluded from school, often feel shame. They feel blamed, even though it might be a major genetic contribution to it. So there is no pressure group for them. There is no charity for them, even though it's the commonest mental health problem we have in country and indeed worldwide. So autism or eating disorders all have lots of people jumping up and down saying we need more resources. This lot don't. I was pleased to be able to chair a nice guideline group on what evidence work in conjunction with the British Psychological Society and the Social Care Institute for Excellence. And there is lots and lots of evidence that evidence-based so-called parenting programs really work to help these children and families. It sounds rather simplistic, doesn't it? But actually encouraging them to behave well, because a child who is being quiet and neutral and not misbehaving is not a problem, and even the most difficult ones, 90% of the time, they're okay. So if you can encourage that by saying, I really like it when you're playing quietly, I like it when you eat nicely, when you ask your sister, if you can borrow her toys rather than snatch them, and so on, this has a powerful effect before we come on to clear strategies for sanctions and consequences if they misbehave in a non-angry way. And so that's what my trials and practice have been on, and the good programs have a really strong effect, and we've shown that even with 4 to 7 year olds, we've found in mid-adolescence, by their teenage, we're still seeing the good effects of that. So a powerful intervention to help these kind of children.
And could you talk a little bit about the kind of specific challenges, I suppose, that children who have been adopted or fostered face?
Well, they face a raft of problems, potentially, depending, of course, when they were taken into care. Because if they, nowadays, people want to try and help support people in their birth families, but that may mean that abuse carries on, and that has effects on lots of their systems, their emotional systems for coping and feel comforted, their ability to get socialized into good behavior and also to get good learning habits, so they fall behind quite badly at school. So they have a whole raft of problems, and the Office of National Statistics survey shows they have 5 times, that's 500%, more mental health difficulties than children in the general population. So that means that about 50% have mental health problems or at a diagnosable level, compared with 10% in the general population. There's no one particular abuse pattern, they get everything more commonly. So this is challenging for fostering and adoptive parents, who do, on the whole, a fantastic job, sometimes putting up with some quite difficult children. And actually, the most therapeutic thing for these children is a loving, warm family who instill some good habits and have some good times with them and bring the good out in them. That is more therapeutic than any amount of 5 times a week therapy.
Yeah, it sounds like a challenging area to work in. I mean, could you expand a little bit about your research interests and kind of a little bit more about those parenting programs that you've looked into?
Well, we've looked into a number of parenting programs, and indeed, under two governments ago, we got quite a lot of money, £30 million, to set up something called the National Academy for Parenting Practitioners and Research. And there we rated all the programs and trained 4,000 people in the more effective ones, of which there are about 10, which have been shown to work. So what is disappointing is there are quite a lot of programs out there which are based on the wrong theory, don't have very skilled practitioners, and sometimes have been shown not to work, but still they're being peddled by people who have an interest, either because it's a charity set up for that particular thing or they get money for it. And my own private view is that's unethical. You wouldn't really, for someone, a child with appendicitis, say, well, you know, you can have an operation, but actually we're going to put herbs in your stomach. That would be considered unethical. So to me, if someone is psychologically distressed and unwell when you've got something that's proven to work, I think it's cruel to use ineffective interventions. So we've been using ones which go along the lines I was talking about of what I call love and limits, giving the warmth, encouraging them to do the things that will make them feel good about themselves, and setting firm limits when they go wrong. And we've shown that that actually helps families as well. Their siblings do better. Their parents are less angry with them, so they're copping less negativity and more positivity. So their day-to-day living is much nicer. And I think it's interesting when we role-play to parents what it is with people telling you off all the time and getting at you and getting angry at you. It's not a nice experience. So it's pleasing when you can turn this around, but we're having difficulties getting these treatments rolled out. You will know that child and adolescent mental health services are horribly underfunded. For outpatient services, something like £50 per head of population per year, and often conduct problems, antisocial behaviour won't be seen at all. It'll be excluded, unless it's with something else like autism or ADHD. So that is terribly sad for this group. So we're trying to, through ACAM, put the case, although we're not a campaigning organisation, we advocate for evidence-based treatment for those in need.
That's fantastic to hear, because it's interesting you mentioned the kind of disparity between evidence-based medical treatments, physical medical treatments, and treatments for mental health problems, conduct problems. I mean, is this quite a challenge in psychiatry, or is it, you know, is the picture more hopeful than that?
Well, I think it's a challenge in mental health. I wouldn't say just psychiatry. It's true in psychology and other practitioners. So I think for things like anxiety and depression, more generic counselling and things like that certainly do help. Once you get more severe, you probably need something like CBT, but there are alternatives. And so I think we need to keep making sure that people are being offered these things rather than more generic things. They need an assessment. Often a lot of conditions are missed, PTSD, that sort of thing, which are eminently treatable by CBT, to give the example of post-traumatic stress disorder or anxiety. Those respond particularly well to CBT. Depression, there are other treatments as well. But we have to keep fighting for these interventions to be used. And I think that's one reason I joined ACAM, is to try and get the message out there. I think when you're a busy clinician, head down in a clinic, you haven't got time to go telling people how fantastic the treatments are. And I think people are very surprised when I talk to politicians. Gosh, I didn't realize you had all this breadth of knowledge and skills in how to. I thought it was just having a chat with an unhappy child. It isn't. And so the latest meta-analysis by a chap called John Weiss in Harvard found over 500 randomized controlled trials in our field for treatment, psychological treatments. So there is a huge evidence base, and we're bad at telling people about this.
So, Stephen, I mean, you've had a really interesting career. Could, when you look back on your time as a psychiatrist, as a researcher, are there any things that stand out as particular highlights for you?
Well, I think a couple of trends spring to mind. The first is when I did my first degree, we thought all people were basically the same and it was their experiences that made them different. When I trained, autism was thought to be due to refrigerator mothers, and that autism was a retreat because they had unbearable parents, and so they had to be in their own world as an escape from that. We now know it's almost entirely genetic. For example, in my own particular field of antisocial behavior, whereas common or garden antisocial behavior is mainly determined by the way you're brought up, there's a subvariant, so-called callous unemotional traits. These are these sort of mini psychopaths, which is very, very genetic, and however you bring them up. So that's been really interesting, and that complex interaction between who you are and the way you're brought up that occurs too in your learning and intelligence. So that's been fascinating. The other thing that has come on in leaps and bounds in the last 25 years or so is so-called implementation science. By that I mean, of course, it's glory to find the gene for something or find the cause of depression is lack of daylight or cortisol hormones, but actually learning how to make people better and the way the training makes a difference, how to engage parents, how long they need to have treatment for with their children, what are the factors in a treatment? Is it the niceness of the therapist with a young person? Is it the diaries they keep in the homework? That has advanced so much. A small matter of making people better has come on in leaps and bounds, and that's a big change. Before, when I started, therapy was something that sort of went behind closed doors. Nobody really talked about what you did. Nobody had a manual to know if you're doing what you said you should be doing or whether you went off piste and just did something rather weird and different. So that has changed hugely, and one of our own studies looked at the therapist skill in the outcome of groups run with parents for children who are antisocial. And I was shocked that the correlation between their skill, independently assessed by looking at videotapes, and outcome was 0.7. And in the ineffective groups, they weren't sticking to the manual. They weren't doing it very skillfully. They were talking about lots of nice things. The parents liked it, talking about whether beans should be bought in Tesco's or Marks and Spencer's or Sainsbury's or Aldi. So they came and they had a nice chat, but it didn't make any difference to the children.
That's heartening.
Well, it does mean that actually what they're doing matters. It isn't just a warm relationship. You need both. You need the warm relationship and you need the specificity of the intervention. And then we can get motoring. And so now the other issue is going into preventive public health, which has become onto the thing. So now the green paper with the government is about trying to get in early and not just cutting out the bad, not just being a psychological surgeon, getting rid of the nasty bits, but actually promoting resilience and well-being. Another trial I've been involved in with Russell Viner at the Institute of Child Health and Chris Bunnell at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, who lead it, those two, is on restorative justice in secondary schools to make children sort things out amongst themselves and say what the impact of bullying and things is. And this is being shown to be effective. So I think we need to raise well-being as well as reduce distress due to disorders.
I've noticed this kind of change in the in a focus more on prevention. Are you seeing this as well then? Is this becoming a priority, do you think? And is that a good thing?
Well, I think it's a good thing, but I think some people have an overvalued idea about it. It's a bit like apple pie in the American way of life. It is thought, a minister I was speaking to 3 months ago said, isn't it great that we can reduce CAM services because we'll nip everything in the bud when they're young? And I said, well, no, minister, if you look at the major problems, depression probably doesn't start till teenage years in most cases. Schizophrenia, psychosis doesn't. You can't spot them in primary school age. And actually, only a quarter of people get any treatment at the minute. So if anything, it's going to increase the flow onto mental health services rather than reduce it. So I'm all for prevention, both universal and targeted, but it's not going to do away with the need for treatment for cases. We can't prevent quite a lot. We can try.
And looking into the future now for you, Stephen, I mean, what's on the horizon for you? What's on the horizon for you from a research point of view, and kind of what are some of the challenges within child and adolescent psychiatry at the moment? What are some of the big challenges?
Well, I think the challenges in child and adolescent mental health, not just psychiatry, are personalising interventions. I mean, we always do that because we see every case as different. But if they've got, say, two different problems at the same time, how do we address those so-called comorbidities if they have both antisocial behaviour and severe anxiety? And so I'm involved in a research project with the Tavistock Clinic, Rob Senior, on trying to personalise treatment for children with conduct problems. For most treatments, psychological therapies will help perhaps two-thirds, but there'll still be a third who aren't getting better. Why is that? How can we help them? What's going on? Is it that the child isn't responsive, or in the parenting interventions, is it the parents couldn't change because the parents are depressed or subject to domestic violence or misusing drugs? How are we going to get things better? So I find that quite exciting, how we're going to get a higher proportion of people to a better state of wellness. And I think that's the other thing is, in ACAM, I'm very keen that we disseminate good practice. So we hold a lot of conferences. We have branches all over the UK and in Ireland, including ERA, so that we can help people learn from each other and push forward the effective treatments. I'm keen that I think something that's been hugely missing in our whole field is parental and the young people's involvement in arguing the case. If it's all secret and behind closed doors, politicians don't get to hear about it. We need all of us to put pressure on to say, this is shameful, this really affects people. So following cancer, depression is the largest cause of worldwide morbidity and, by the way, loss of earnings of any disorder, physical or mental. We need to get these messages out. The charitable spend for every pound of government money on research is £2.75 for cancer for every pound given by the government. It's 0.1 of a penny in mental health. There's very little charitable awareness. So again, we need to get more research done. Those are things that I think could go forward and excite me about the future.
And moving on to your time with ACAM, how did you get involved with ACAM in the first place, and why?
Well, I was on the board, and when they publish a journal called the Journal of Child Psychology and Psychiatry, which is arguably the leading one in the world, which is nice, doing just as well as American counterparts. And it had a second clinical journal, which I edited, and then I was on the board, and then I left, and then I was asked to apply for the post of chair, which I was very excited by. So that's how I came back into it. Because as well as being specific things, I am quite a generalist. And with a guy called Robert Goodman, who did the Office of National Statistics Surveys, we wrote a textbook. So that made us review all the evidence across a wide range of subjects. So I feel that helped me understand all the different conditions that we try and help in ACAM and the different practitioners in it. And we've completely revamped the organization. We've got a new chief executive. We've rebranded it. We've repurposed it. We've got a marketing manager. We are, shock horror for someone of my age, going digital and tweeting and using social media, not just paper. And we're doing a lot of things like we're doing today, but also we are developing our online resources and collaborating with something called MindEd, who offer education not just for professionals but for parents about mental health conditions. So we're trying to go places and also be more outward looking. That means partnering up with other organizations. For example, we run a joint conference with something called Place to Be, which do counseling in schools. Teamed up with Young Minds, a charity for young people with mental health concerns, to disseminate e-learning interventions and things like this. I think we've got so much to do.
Yeah, and over the next few years, I mean, what do you see as some of the things that you'd like to achieve with ACAM? As the chair or as a member as well, what would you like to see?
I'd like to see be part of a movement towards more understanding of conditions and what can work. So I think we have to, both amongst the professionals, get them doing more good stuff. I think we need to get the public asking for it. That would be an index of success to me. And although it's not in our gift and we're not campaigning, I think there needs to be more money spent in the field. That would be success for me.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much for your time today, Stephen. I really, really appreciate it.
Okay, well, it's been great to talk about it. Thank you very much.
This podcast was brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short.